At KFC, everyday value meets big flavor. That means getting 6 crispy pieces of delicious dark meat drums and thighs, plus 4 biscuits, all for just $10 with our Dine and Dash deal. All that juicy, original recipe chicken for only 10 bucks every day. Now that's finger-lickin' good. Hurry into KFC and taste the deal we're cooking up. Limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. While supplies last, tax, tip, and fees extra. Not available on third-party ordering platforms.
Welcome to Indoctrination, a weekly conversation series about protecting yourself from systems of control. I'm your host, Rachel Bernstein.
Hello, everybody. Today on the show, we have Pamela Nicol Williams. I'm going to be actually speaking with her twice. So this is an introduction for the part one of our conversation. There is so much to cover that it kind of spilled over into a whole other conversation. And it is really, really all so powerful. Pamela Nicol Williams was born into Scientology. Her parents were early Scientologists who worked closely with L. Ron Hubbard at the First Church of Scientology in the late 1950s and were practicing members of the church until the late 1970s. After years of burying her childhood memories, Pamela began writing and documenting her experiences, seeking to acknowledge the abuse she suffered and to try and understand the dysfunction that existed within her family due to Scientology's beliefs and practices. Her soon-to-be-released memoir, Clearly Lies Are True, is a powerful and compelling firsthand narrative account of her experiences as a child during the early inception of Scientology. As both a cult survivor and a survivor of sexual abuse, her book chronicles her parents' search for total freedom, her sexual abuse at the hands of her father, and her mother's psychosis, which was brought on by Scientology. Pamela is now an accomplished educator who has taught in the public education system, the private sector, and in higher education. You can find out more about Pamela and her forthcoming memoir at www.clearlyliesaretrue.com. Here is Pam now. It is such a treat to have Pamela Nicol Williams with me today. Pam, I am so looking forward to having you share your story and having you get into as much as we can today. And it might continue during another episode too, because there's a lot to cover. And there are a lot of details. There's a lot of history, a lot of family history, but a lot of themes also that are really important to get into. And a really important question, too, that I saw in some of your writing about sort of what comes first, the chicken or the egg, you know, do you have issues and then get involved in Scientology, or get involved in Scientology and then have issues, or a little bit of both? And understanding that, because that's something that I deal with a lot with my clients, wanting to know where the issues originated. And so welcome to the show. It's wonderful to have you here.
Thank you so much, Rachel. I really appreciate you having me on your show. And I just really appreciate the safe space that you provide on your podcast. You know, I've been listening to, you know, your episodes, and you really make sure that people feel comfortable. And you're so great at making sense of what we share. So I really appreciate that. So I'm looking forward to that.
That's very sweet of you to say. I've talked a little bit about this on the podcast, but when I did the first episode, so some people have heard this, but when I did the first episode, it was with this woman who had been involved in countercult work for many years because her father, Leo J. Ryan, was the congressman killed at Jonestown. And I asked her to be my first guest because it was through what happened at Jonestown that a lot of people learned about cults sometimes for the first time and what can happen. After I finished interviewing her, I was listening to it. And then I thought, there's this piece missing, not from her, but just I could tell, or I was assuming that the audience would be listening and saying, but how? But why? And so I wanted to do this little thing. And I thought, well, maybe before people go, I can add something. And so that's how I started the one more thing before you go. Like, here's this piece that might help to answer some of the questions that listeners are going to potentially have when they're hearing this guest. I want you to do most of the talking because you have so much to share. But I do want to start by saying the following, that it's an interesting thing, the impact that Scientology's had on me for the last 33 years or so, because I had heard about it. I had heard about Scientology. I'd gone to Cult Awareness Network conferences. Now it's run by Scientologists, but at the time it wasn't. And, you know, people were there. Heber Gentsch, I think, was in, you know, there and got to know him and his family. And I got my counseling license, started working at a place called the Cult Clinic in Los Angeles, which is now no longer because of Scientology pressure. And I suddenly had someone waiting in the waiting area who looked emaciated and very pale. And she came into my office, asked if I could keep the door open. She was looking for recording devices, looking for electrodes that she was told I was going to put on her head as a therapist. She had climbed out of a window. She was on the RPF in a building in Hollywood, not far from where the cult clinic was. And she was terrified. She actually couldn't stay for more than a few minutes, but she wanted to almost kind of let me know this is happening. And then she went back. I guess someone saw her coming back because there were cameras everywhere, or someone asked her. And then she was just sort of asked and asked and asked until she disclosed where she went and who she met with. And then the next thing I know, I'm getting harassed by Scientology. And they sent in a crew dressed like a janitorial staff to go through my client files. And I had them locked up, but you could see they tried to jam the drawers open and try to unlock all the information so they could, I'm sure, contact all of these people who I was seeing. And then they contacted my board to file a complaint against me. And the things they accused me of, this was fascinating because this is also when I learned a lot about how manipulators and even people who are narcissistic work, where they accuse you of doing the things that they're doing. So suddenly I got this thing from my board saying that I was accused of kidnapping, of extortion, of all the things, right? All the things that they were kind of doing in their own way. And then I had Eugene Ingram and J.J. Gaw, who were these discredited LAPD officers who were hired by Scientology, to be leaning against my car when I came out of work and following me home and being out in front of my apartment at the time. And I never met people like this close up. I mean, they were really thuggish and scary. And I stayed home. I stayed home. I thought, not worth it. Nope. Thought it was a good idea at the time. And I'm in my early 20s. I have no idea what's happening. And then I heard my dad had passed away, I think the year prior to all of this. And I heard his voice in my head where he said, "You can't let the bullies win." And then I went back to work, and not without trepidation and not without still being followed, but it lit a fire under me, which I think was not their intention, because I thought, if I'm going through this, I can only imagine what people who have really dealt with science, who have been there since the start, who have had access to information and who they really see as quote unquote enemies, what they're going through. And what I'm going through is probably nothing in comparison. So that helped me have some perspective. So that was that. And it's been pretty continuous with the, you know, complaints to the board, blah, blah, blah. But it's sort of par for the course. And I say blah, 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 because it's been 30, years, but it was not blah, blah, blah at the time. And so they are a real force to be reckoned with, not just in this way, but also emotionally, because I think there's a real emotional and psychological hangover in a lot of ways for people who have been through the ringer with them. And hearing about your childhood story of so much, the word upheaval kept coming up in my mind, so much upheaval, having to start again and starting again in a new place with a lot of shifts in your parents' life and health, et cetera. You've been through a lot of change and you probably love stability right now. And so I wanted to just offer you that part of my history with them, with this organization, but also as a way of really kind of commending you for pushing forward with your story, because I think people don't realize how much courage it takes. So now, back to you.
Thank you for sharing that, Rachel. That really does give me some context there for, you know, your experience with Scientology and your understanding. So you experienced fair game firsthand. You know exactly, you know, what that feels like. And my story is so different than so many ex-Scientologists in that I'm a little older and that my parents were involved from the onset of Scientology. And so, you know, that my father read Dianetics, the Modern Science of Mental Health, you know, when it was published in 1950, and he lived in Wichita, Kansas, and he became really involved in Scientology and started participating in, you know, auditing and hearing Hubbard, you know, lecture, and he was all in. He was definitely a true believer from, you know, the minute he read that book and started participating. He met my mom and they got married in 1955. She was not a Scientologist at the time. You know, she was not part of that. But my father was, you know, very persuasive. And I think at that time in my mom's life, you know, it was the 50s and she had left college because she couldn't finish college. She couldn't afford it. And, you know, you needed to be married in the 50s to be able to support yourself. You know, either that or you were, you know, a spinster and became a, you know, a teacher or a nurse or, you know, there weren't a lot of options or a secretary. And so, you know, she married my father and he convinced her that they should go to Washington, D.C., where L. Ron Hubbard had moved. The Wichita church had closed down for financial issues, always Hubbard's issue, you know, the finances and the tax evasion. So they moved to Washington, D.C. and followed Hubbard, where he started the founding Church of Scientology. And so they were there from 1957 to 1959. And I was born in 1958. So right around the same time, just a little bit after Arthur Hubbard, who is L. Ron Hubbard's fourth child, his baby, and Mary Sue Hubbard and my mom were pregnant at the same time and very involved. My parents were very involved in Scientology. It was small, you know, it was the Hubbard Association of Scientologists. And my parents helped put on the congresses that were held where Scientologists would come. And the seminars, you know, they worked side by side with L. Ron Hubbard and Mary Sue Hubbard. And for, you know, a brief period of time, but still, I always say it was like a grassroots movement, you know, in doing my research about it. That's what it reminds me of. And my parents, they didn't talk a lot about that period of time, but they had fond memories when they would share, you know, that those were fond memories. They felt like they were part of something big. Something that was going to help the world, something that was, you know, a positive. They didn't see it as a negative, I think, during mm-hmm. that period of time.
Mm-hmm. Okay, that's interesting. And I remember reading about your father liking kind of the books that were science fiction books and being drawn in. What do you think, or even originally back then, what was the attraction for him? What did he like so much about L. Ron Hubbard? And why did he see himself as being sort of akin to him in terms of the way he thought?
What a great question. You know, so my father, so I was sexually abused by my father when I was a young child. And my father died when I was 19. And became really sick when I was 13. He had multiple sclerosis, and it was a pretty fast trajectory downward. And he was in a nursing home, you know, when I was 14, and then in the VA hospital. So I have a short period of time that I knew my father. I always like to preface it that way. And, you know, I have a brother who's still living, and, you know, both of my parents are gone now. But in speaking to my brother, we both agree that my father was an enigma. He always saw himself as someone more important than who he was. So I think this was a way to attach to something, you know, bigger than he was, and to have that importance. I think that my father was in some ways narcissistic in a similar way. I think that I know this, that, you know, he had a very addictive personality. And so, you know, he was overweight his whole life. So he was an overeater, and he battled his weight his whole life. When my mother met him, he had just lost a whole bunch of weight. And I think that part of that may have been connected to, he felt that Scientology had helped him with that. And then also, you know, he had some sexual identity issues. I learned later in life from my mother that he was bisexual. So he had a lot going on. I think, though, that he really just was drawn, you know, maybe an analogy would be, you know, our political system right now, that people are drawn to that very strong, charismatic, narcissistic personality, in that it feels empowering.
Yeah, it is like moth to a flame kind of a feeling. And I think also people will sometimes, after they take some time away, either from the group that they're involved in or a relationship with a narcissist, or even shift political parties, they sometimes feel like they're coming to. They say they were almost in a hypnotic trance, which is fascinating when you see that. I'm wondering also about L. Ron Hubbard's family, because while I've met some of them, and so I've gotten some of the behind the scenes still, what a strange thing, right? To be married to L. Ron Hubbard, to be one of his children, or even grandchildren or great-grandchildren. I mean, it is really fascinating. And I think also to be a wife of his, and to also, you know, be the one to have to be accused of things, to go down, you know, when the proverbial, you know, what hits the fan, and, you know, everyone else seems to get blamed. So you had to be willing to sacrifice yourself, you know, for the cause if you were going to be with him. What do you remember about any of his family that you could let us know about, kind of give us a vision of them?
Well, I knew them as a child, the Hubbard children. And so I'll kind of fast forward a little bit then in my chronology. So when in 1967, we were on the Royal Scotsman, which was the very first Scientology ship with the Hubbards. So with Mary Sue and L. Ron Hubbard, and then the four children. And then it was not the Sea Organization at that time. It was called the Sea Project. So, you know, Hubbard had been in St. Hill, and then he left D.C. because, you know, they were on his tails as far as taxes. So he'd gone over to St. Hill, and he had established, you know, Scientology there, and bigger and grander than it had been before in the 60s. And so my mother and my little brother and I went to St. Hill. And my mother took the St. Hill briefing course there. That was the biggest, you know, tech that was going on at the time. And Hubbard lectured, and there were the tapes and all of that. And so the Hubbard kids were there also at St. Hill. I don't remember interacting with them at all, because my brother and I, stayed with a family while my mother was involved with her training during the day. So we didn't interact with them. But in 1967, in the middle of the night, we'd come home from school, and my mother said, you know, don't change out of your uniforms, because we were going to the Episcopal school there in England while we were there. And, you know, we're going to be driving, and we're going to need to go at night. And, you know, it's going to take a long time. And she had packed this is kind of the backstory to get to your question. But she had packed this trunk, kind of like a trunk that, you know, an army person might use.
Like a steamer trunk.
Yeah, like a steamer trunk. And that had all our stuff on it. And it had her name on it and our address from where we had lived in Louisiana before we'd gone over to England. And so I thought that was kind of weird. We were putting that in the car. I didn't know the person who was driving us. So we drive, and my little brother and I fall asleep. And then we wake up, And there we are in the middle of the night at the docks in Southampton. And no idea where we were and who these people were, but we were, you know, told to get out of the car, to be very quiet. You know, it was like a stealth mission, you know, like you had to get on board quietly. Nobody had to know. Nobody could see you. And so we boarded the ship, and it was a very old ship. You know, it was in bad shape, if you've read any of the history of it. So it wasn't in good shape. And we went up, and then we went down. So went up the stairs and then went down into the berthing area. And my mother tucked us in to these beds, and we were still in our uniforms and, you know, said goodnight. And we were on the ship for about 2 months. And my mother, yeah. So my mother was receiving auditing while she was on the ship. So it was, like I said, before the Sea Org. So the Sea Project was the beginnings of it. So there was the Scientology crew, and then that maiden voyage into the Mediterranean, his very first, you know, trip into the sea happened. And that was November of 1967. And my little brother and my mom and I woke up the next morning after that. It was a very horrific maiden voyage. It was rough seas. It's a miracle that the ship didn't capsize, that there weren't injuries, that, you know, something really horrific didn't happen, because the crew had no idea how to sail a ship. L. Ron Hubbard had no idea how to sail a ship. You know, it's really like through the grace of God, you know, or something, that everybody was safe. So we wake up the next morning, though, and the deck is covered with water, and people are mopping and people are, you know, cleaning up. And my mom comes and gets us, and she says, "You have to come upstairs and you have to help clean up." And so she takes my brother over to this bell that's on the deck. And and I forget what the bell is used for, but, you know, I think it's like an alarm bell, you know, that's rung for certain things. And so my brother takes this rag, my mom hands him, and starts, you know, shining it. And then my mom says, "Oh, you're doing such a great job." And she's like making a really big deal out of it. And I'm thinking, why is she making such a big deal out of this? Like, you know, this is just weird. And then she said, "You hear everybody, like, he's coming." So L. Ron Hubbard was coming up on deck. And everybody, you know, was, you know, just stood to attention. They're getting their job done as the very best they can. You know, and this ship is a mess. I mean, the paint is peeling off. It's all rusty. I mean, you know, it's not like this beautiful ship that you have to take care of, you know. And he comes over. So I grab the rag and I go over to the railing, and I'm like, you know, pretending that I'm cleaning it. And I'm just looking out of the corner of my eye, and I see him come over, and I'm thinking, oh, he's going to come over and he's going to tell me, you know, I'm doing such a good job. You know, this is what my mom wants and everybody wants. And he was right next to me, stood right next to me, looked out on the horizon right over me, said not one word, not one word to me. So I was invisible. You know, I never really thought about that memory until I started writing my book and thinking about my time on the ship. And then that memory came up, and I'm like, ah, it makes sense now. It makes sense now, that whole narcissistic personality and everything, you know, I'd read about him and learned about him. But in that moment, I remember feeling kind of crestfallen as a kid, like, I'm doing my very best here, you know, and I'm just not being recognized for it. So that was my only interaction with him. But we did get tutored on the ship with the Hubbard children. So when Mary Sue and, you know, Ron went to St. Hill, I'm not sure. I assume they had a tutor there for the kids. I'm not really sure. But when they moved to the ship, you know, they were really displaced. Mary Sue and the kids, you know, they had this beautiful home, this huge mansion, you know, in England with, you know, all this rolling countryside and just a great place to grow up for kids, horses. And now they were on the ship. So I think that was probably really hard for them, for that family. And so Mary Sue had, and I included in my book, she had made I call it a proclamation, but, you know, there was a memo that went out that no one could interrupt the education of the children on the ship during the tutoring hours, and that anyone that did, there were going to be really harsh consequences, you know. And those harsh consequences on the ship, it was the beginning of liability, they used to call it, where you wear a white rag around your arm to show that you've done something, you know, unethical or something wrong. And they would take away privileges like, you know, cigarette breaks and, you know, things like that. And so that was really serious, in that it meant a lot to her that her kids continue to have some sort of normalcy is what I, you know, as a mom, that's what I read into it, you know, when I read it later. So we were in a special part of the ship that was much nicer than where our birthing area was. There was actually, you know, this really nice wood that was in the ship and reddish, beautiful curtains, I remember. And it was later turned into Hubbard's study area, I learned. That's where we and the kids were. And there was a Scientologist who was older. She's probably like 40, but she seemed really old, you know, compared to all the other Scientologists on the ship who were in their, you know, 20s. But she was our tutor and she had been an educator. And I remember sitting, and Arthur was a, you know, he's an artist. And so he was always drawing. He was always drawing. So I really, even though he was my same age, I really didn't interact with him much. Diana wasn't there because she was very immersed in Scientology. You know, she was older, 16, I think. And so that was already what she was doing. Quentin wasn't there either. And he was probably about 13 or so at that time. And he was, you know, already involved with auditing and they were grooming him. So it was Suzette and Arthur. So Suzette was impish, is what I remember. I remember her sitting like on these seats and she would just sit there and really not pay attention at all to what the tutor was saying and not engage in it. You know, they were there, but they were not really into learning. And, you know, there wasn't a lot of learning anyway. We did some reading and things like that. But Quentin was just such a special person. I did have interactions with him and he was so sweet to me. I remember just, I mean, I probably had like a little crush on him. You know, I was 9 and he was 13, but he really just was such a gentle soul. And he took me on a tour of his cabins and showed me, you know, where he was and, you know, don't you have something like this, you know, down below? And I said, no, we don't, you know, and maybe I should talk to my, you know, my mom about that and see. And, you know, I just smiled and, you know, he just chatted with me. But I really felt that he was so, I don't know, ethereal is maybe the word. Like he just really had this presence, but he was not a part of what was going on with Scientology, even though, you know, that was his father and what he had to do. And he was in his little, you know, white uniform. It was the beginning of the Sierra uniforms. He just really was not, you know, as engaged in that. He had visions, you know, of what he might do if he wasn't on the ship. You know, he wanted to be a pilot. You know, that was something he was really involved in. Yeah. So that was my, you know, my brief interactions with them. But they, you know, like all families, each of the children were different.
Right. That's so interesting. I've had every once in a while there've been people who have come to my office or who I've met at conferences, and they don't necessarily introduce themselves right away, but they say they've had quite an experience growing up in Scientology, and they're part of a legacy family. And but the genes are very strong, and you can often tell who they're related to, which is very interesting. You know, I won't say, but I'll sort of know. But that it's such an interesting time also for you to talk about being on these ships and being at the beginning where things were really a wreck. I mean, the ship was a wreck and just that no one really knew how to sail. And just, I think, either the bravery or hubris, I don't know what it is, right, of L. Ron Hubbard to just take people out to sea without knowing what he's doing, which is really fascinating. So I didn't know it had such a rough and tumble beginning and that you were a part of that. That's really quite amazing. Wow.
Yeah. And I didn't realize until I started my writing how much a part of Scientology history my family had been. I really didn't grasp that as a child. And even, you know, once we came home and then we moved out to California and, you know, that's when we were really involved in Scientology and I became involved in Scientology. I didn't really understand that legacy. I didn't get it, you know, and I think maybe because it was still too new, the ship changing names was just happening during that period of time in the 70s and becoming the Apollo. And, you know, we offboarded in January and then that's when all public was taken off the ship and then it became the Sea Organization. And that's really when that became entrenched, you know, in the culture of Scientology. But there was this very short period of time, you know, when that wasn't the case. And it was getting figured out, I think. I think Hubbard was deciding how that was going to roll out. And I think he was also just trying to find a safe haven because he was escaping, you know, tax evasion. And there's lots of stories about how they wouldn't let us into some of the ports.
Incredible. Wow. Incredible. Okay. So now back to your world here. You're on a boat. And then where did you land? Where did you set up, you know, where did your parents set up a home for you?
We moved around a lot. So, you know, from DC, we moved to Denver, Colorado when I was little, about 3 or 4 years old. And we followed Scientologists because once Hubbard left DC, the Hubbard Association of Scientologists, they kind of had to figure out what they were going to do, people who had been involved. And so you could form a franchise at that time. You know, that was still okay. And Hubbard was at the beginning of wanting to disseminate Scientology. So franchises were approved. You could go and, you know, you use the Scientology tech, but you started it someplace else. So they followed Scientologists who did that. And so we were in Denver for a few years. And then we moved to Louisiana, which is a very strange move. I have, you know, researched it so much in the writing of my story. And the best I can figure out, because there was no Scientology going on in Louisiana at the time. We lived in this little small town outside of New Orleans. But I think it was for my father's work, because he worked in aerospace and there was a NASA plant that opened up there. And so I'm pretty sure, you know, it was for a job opportunity. And from there, that's when we went to St. Hill and then we went to the ship. And so we came back for a minute to Louisiana. And it wasn't long, though, before my parents, they didn't have a great marriage. And the separation of my mother going to St. Hill and, you know, taking my little brother and I and not being with my father probably didn't help anything. And then when she came back, and I'll just add this, it's always so strange to me in that my father was the true believer, but my mother was the one that was constantly being immersed in Scientology. And the best I can figure out from my, you know, perspective as a child at the time, and just from kind of researching what was going on in Scientology during that period of time, is I think that my mom was that scapegoat, that my father had so many issues, but that she became the problem. So it needed to always be about fixing my mother. It was her issues. It was what was wrong with her, right? So we came back and my parents had this terrible fight. My mother threw coffee on my father and they were screaming and yelling. And my little brother and I had witnessed some arguments, but nothing like this. So it was pretty intense. And at the end of it, my mother, we came out, we were hiding and my mother, you know, found us and she said, "So you're going to have to make a decision. You're going to have to decide whether you're going to stay here with your father or whether you're going to go with me." And so I was 9, soon to be 10. And my brother's about, you know, 3 and 4 years younger. And I thought, well, where is she going? Like, I don't even know where she's going, right? And do I want to stay here? And so, you know, I didn't even know what to say. And, you know, it came to pass, of course, they made the decision for us. And so we stayed with my father and my mom came to Los Angeles. And she came to get more auditing and more training. And, you know, the Advanced Organization of Los Angeles had just opened up in LA during the 70s or late 60s and early 70s. And so that was kind of the latest and the greatest. You know, St. Hill had been the place to go, and now it was Los Angeles. And so she came out on her own, and we stayed back with my dad for about probably 6 months, 6 to 9 months. And then we moved and, you know, I write about this, Rachel, that from a child's perspective, again, I didn't get what was going on. And when you've lived, you know, that kind of a life, you just learn not to question. You know, you learn that it's just, okay, this is one more thing that's going to happen that we navigate, right? And so when it came time to move, all of our furniture was taken. I mean, the house was empty. My dad told my little brother and I that we could each take a toy on the trip. we drove. It was a road trip to California. And we had to give away everything, everything. In hindsight, I realized that the house was foreclosed on and our possessions were, you know, repossessed. They had spent so much money on Scientology, you know, going to just think of that, you know, we stayed in a hotel at St. Hill, all that training and auditing, all the expenses of Scientology, plus lodging, plus airfare. You know, my father probably couldn't make that money fast enough. We were spending it faster, you know, than he could make it. So that was a very sad time. Even though I didn't know that at the time that that was happening, I sensed it. I sensed it, you know, my father's sadness also. I sensed, you know, what was going on. So that's where we came home to. And then we got in the car and we drove to California.
Which is a really long drive.
It's a really long drive from Louisiana. But we did it in like probably 3 to 4 days.
That's incredible, actually. And I think also, you know, now looking at it at, from the distance that you have it, you know, where you can see the dichotomy and you can see the, yes, it was foreclosed upon. Otherwise, you would have, you know, the furniture and everything would have been moved with you, or you wouldn't have had to leave at all. That here, your parents were out of funds or your father was out of funds. You didn't have anything, but your mom is in Los Angeles, I'm sure paying dearly for all these courses or auditing. And that's an interesting irony. And I see that a lot, that suddenly a family has nothing and they somehow still need to pay for things. Or even just the, you know, freeloader debt or whatever it is that suddenly gets added on to your life that is this financial burden when you really have nothing. And it makes me really wonder about this group. I mean, I've wondered about this group for a long time, but just it feels heartless when you look at it that way, that here this was a family that has given so much, that uprooted their kids, brought them on a boat for months. And they almost died at sea and all these things, but still they have nothing, but still they have to keep giving. And, you know, it makes me really frustrated when I hear these stories because it's so wrong. And you want there to be a, you know what? Thank you. Thank you for all your dedication in the early days, especially. And thanks for believing in me. And here, let me gift you with this, or at least give you a livable wage so that you can raise your kids safely in the same home. But that never happened.
No. And I think that, you know, and I agree with everything that you're saying. Sadly, that's not Scientology. Not at all. You know, it's a narcissistic organization. It's all about moving up the bridge and getting people to pay to move up the bridge. You know, it's all about that, you know, devised hierarchy of levels, you know, that Hubbard created. And you reach one and then you've got to get to the next one and then the next one. And it's never ending. It's never ending. You're never going to be done. You're never going to get to where it is, you know, you want to be or where they tell you you should be, because there's going to be something new, you know, that comes out. And that was definitely happening when my parents were involved in Scientology. And so I think that coupled with the fact that my mom became the problem. My mom became the one that Scientology needed to fix. And so it was an opportunity for Scientology to say, no, you've got to keep coming. You've got to keep, you know, now you need to do this and now you need to do that. And I remember finding some writing of my mother's, you know, and it's very sad. When I found it, you know, I didn't get it as a kid. So I actually saved it. When my mom died, I found it in her home. And I saved it. And in writing my story, I went back to it, forgotten I even had it. And she wrote what they call your overts and your withholds, you know, in Scientology, right? And so this was during a period of time that we can maybe get to later when she became agoraphobic. And she really had, she had had a psychotic episode and she really had a lot going on once she came out to California. And so she had written this and it was, you know, I've talked badly about Scientology to my father. I've tried to keep him from being involved in Scientology. I've said bad things, about the people, you know, at the organization and Scientology. You use the words natter. I've nattered about them, which means you've, you know, said bad things. And, you know, she had this whole list of all these terrible things that she had done. And I remember reading it and thinking, but she's the one who's always been involved in Scientology. Like, how is it that she is saying, you know, that she thought it was bad? Because that's all I ever saw was that she was the one. That was the reason we were there, it seemed to me, is because of my mom. I never got until later, you know, that it was really my dad, you know, that was pushing for that.
Oh, it's so interesting. I wonder, you know, just from what you were, and I, you know, I wish you were here for a lot of reasons, for you especially, but if we could ask her these questions. But I wonder how much of it was also a reflection of the times, that so much was placed on the woman as being problematic, they're at fault, and that they would sometimes accept it. You know what? It is because of me. You know, how many women are called crazy when they have just been pushed so far, but then they accept treatment for being the cause of the issue in a way that I would hope that not as many women do now, even though I still see it here and there, but that it becomes also easier to then not be the problem, and then you can smooth everything over. But I see her, or I hear, as you describe it, her internal struggle, that she knew that she had this core sense that was strong enough where she was going to keep her own family of origin from getting involved, which is very interesting. And so there's something that she knew was not a good idea about being involved in it, but still took on the blame. How interesting.
And she really didn't have choices. There weren't that number of choices that there are today for women. No, I definitely agree with that. And so, you know, her choices were limited. Financially, she really didn't have choices. She didn't work. And I think that, you know, for my mom, the writing has really helped me, Rachel, to have empathy for her. I really hated my mom for so many years. You know, I lost her when I was 38. She died suddenly. She had a brain aneurysm and she died. So she was here one day and, you know, gone the next. And we had just started to rebuild our relationship. Like a couple of years before that, I had really tried, you know, to bring her in. You know, I had a family of my own and, you know, as a mom. And I think I was in that place where I wanted to make it right, but I didn't know how. And so, you know, we were both kind of trying. So it's really sad to me that I didn't have a chance to share any of this with her and to have these kind of conversations with her, and that I really was the one for so long that kept that door shut because I didn't want to talk about Scientology. You know, and I think she shut it as well. It was such a not a good part of our lives, you know, for her life nor my life. You know, and once she was able, you know, to leave and to build a new life, I think she was ready to shut the door on it as well and to try her best, you know, to rebuild her life.
Mm-hmm. And so you mentioned, and just to continue speaking about her, kind of memorializing her, honoring her, that she really was suffering, and that to talk a little bit about her psychosis and agoraphobia. So what do you remember about that? And what do you think you understand about that now?
Yeah, yeah. Well, genetics are tricky. I've learned a lot about panic attacks and anxiety through my own. That was something I inherited, lucky me, you know, from probably my mom. But I learned, you know, from later in life and then also as a child. So I'll talk about both. So as a child, when we came out to California, and, you know, we definitely, I want to just highlight this too, like we went from being a middle-class family, you know, in suburbia, even in, you know, in the South, Southern suburbia, to living in an apartment building in downtown Los Angeles in the late 1960s. Because that's where the orgs were, you know, the Scientology organizations. They were all housed in these old craftsman buildings that were cheap property, probably, because they were in downtown LA. And so we lived very close to that. And it was a culture shock for, I'm sure, my parents, you know, and definitely, you know, for my little brother and I. And so I think there was some of that, you know, when we first came out and reconnected with my mom, we had to meet at this hotel and she had to have a Scientology handler there because, you know, she had been doing her training and doing her auditing and things. And so we weren't even in the apartment yet. And then we moved into the apartment and she was gone a lot with doing all of that. And my dad was working. And so, you know, my brother and I fended for ourselves a lot and, you know, learned how to be latchkey kids and all of that. Walked to school through downtown LA. But I think it was gradual, that agoraphobia and that panic that started to set in. And in talking to, you know, other Scientologists, I've learned that that was also that OT level that's connected with Xenu and all of the crazy, you know, stuff that we've read about Scientology and the space aliens and all of that. And that possibly that might have been the catalyst for the psychotic episode. I don't know. I wasn't privy to where she was on the bridge, you know, at that time. And I don't know, but it happened pretty quickly when the psychosis happened. And so my little brother and I remember we were home and my dad was at work and she was in the shower and she was talking in gibberish and singing. And, you know, she certainly didn't sound like my mom. And the biggest thing I remember as a kid was my mom took baths and she was not a person who showered. You know, she just was a bath person. And I remember just thinking at the time that it was so weird that my mom was in the shower. Like, what is she doing in the shower? And then when I heard what was going on, I thought, oh, this is not sounding good, you know? And so I took my little brother and I think we either went outside for a while and, you know, tried to, you know, turn on the TV, watch some cartoons and kind of keep us safe from whatever was going on, was my instinct. And when my dad came home, you know, he was like, where's your mom? You know, where's mom? And then I told him and he went in and I kind of heard some soft talking and everything and he got her out. But I mean, just with a towel wrapped around her, she was sobbing. I mean, it was pretty bad. And then she went to a safe house, like a Scientology safe house. So, you know, again, as a kid, you know, trying to make sense of all of it, I read, you know, through my research that that's what happened with the psychotic episodes during the 70s and that Hubbard prescribed supplements like magnesium and some other things, you know, to get your body back in balance and, you know, you needed quiet and rest and until you were sessionable again, meaning you could be audited and we could take more money from you, right? So that's what happened to her. I'm not sure how long she was there as a kid. I would say, you know, maybe weeks, what it felt like as a kid. And I remember we went to visit her, you know, in the safe house. My dad took me there. And it was like an apartment building like where we lived in that area, but just a smaller one. And she was in a room and, you know, she was coherent and she wasn't psychotic anymore. She wasn't in the same state that I'd seen her because I was afraid. I didn't know what she was going to look like. I didn't know what we were walking into, you know, as a kid. So I remember being really like scared. And she talked to us for a little bit, really not much though. Like, and there was a handler again in the room. So I don't know, you know, if she was worried about what she said or that was just her state of mind at the time. But I remember my dad said, you know, why don't you tell your mom about school? And I remember thinking, okay, but I don't really want to talk. Like, you know, it just didn't feel good, you know, as a kid. And I remember I started talking to my mom about something we were reading in school. And she said to me, so direct and so specific, I don't want to talk about that. I don't want to hear about that. I'm here getting better. And I don't want to talk to you about that. And I remember thinking, wow, she really doesn't care about me. She really doesn't. Like, this is crazy. And I'd never felt that before.
Right, right. From her, although it's reminding me of you cleaning the deck and L. Ron Hubbard just standing next to you and looking out at the sea. But you had never felt that from her because she had been really with you or for you, I suppose, where she, even though she was away physically, you felt that she was with you emotionally. And here she wasn't?
Yes and no. I mean, my mother and I had a strange bond. You know, we had a very strange bond. We were very connected, but we had a very adversarial relationship, I would say. I could never quite please her. You know, I never quite knew what her expectations. I mean, I knew she had really high expectations and that often I was reprimanded for things that, you know, I didn't do correctly or that I should have done. But then she would have this really soft spot also that would happen. And it would surprise me. And it would kind of come out of the blue like it was not expected. And so I think she was torn as well with motherhood and how to balance all of it and how to get what she needed and to be immersed in all this Scientology, you know, stuff that was going on. And I think that she was constantly trying to move out of it, but she couldn't. She was trapped. She was trapped. And so, you know, so I, you know, in hindsight now, I think about that memory. And honestly, I don't think that was my mother there. I don't know who that was. You know, I think that she was just in such a state. So she came home from the safe house. And that's when the agoraphobia really set in, is that she stopped going out. She wasn't even going, you know, to the orgs. She was inside. She was, you know, not even going to the grocery store. My little brother and I were sent out to get, you know, milk, and my mom smoked her whole life and cigarettes, you know, at the local liquor store. She kind of had an agreement with them that they'd, you know, put it in the brown bag for us and, you know, they sold it to us and we take it home, and she didn't go anywhere.
It's so interesting as you're talking about it. I mean, also being raised in Los Angeles during that time, because we're not so different in age. Going downtown was a place you hopefully drove through quickly, because there were a lot of drug deals happening on the street corners and a lot of things happening that were where you were, I'm sure, exposed to a lot just visually, and you had to learn how to really fend for yourself and also how to keep yourself safe and how to keep your head down. And, you know, and I'm sure there are also these little moments of joy and really sweet memories too, but it's harsh. It was a harsh place. The fact that you would get any kind of criticism at all just says, yeah, I think, as you're saying, that your mom was feeling an internal conflict because you were this exemplary parentified child who could be relied upon to basically tend to and raise her brother without parental assistance and to deal with so much change and upheaval, uprooting, and just go along with things. So, you know, the fact that you got any criticism at all is really quite shocking. But yes, as something I think about your mom also and how she was internally, but also that she could come back from the safe house and have agoraphobia, which means to me that the treatment they gave her didn't work. Like, she was still suffering. But they were kind of out of material. Like, there was nothing else they could do, but they didn't refer her to therapy, to a hospital, to go on medication, and to, you know, take L. Ron Hubbard's concoction, which is going to raise your heart rate, which is going to do a lot of things to your body that are, you know, that are going to make everything worse, going to make your symptoms worse. Is just, I mean, it would be malpractice now, right? And so here you had someone, you had a mom who was still really in the throes of things. And one other thing I was going to say, and I want you to then come back to this whole time, because I want to kind of go from there and also to now. There is something interesting that happens where I will sometimes get a call from people's families or from nurses or doctors within psychiatric units. And they'll say, I have someone who just left a particular group and they have the following symptoms. And we need to sort of decipher based on their experience and based on their family history, if what they have is a diagnosis or if it's what we call situational. So if it's situational psychosis or if it is psychosis, and so is it being caused by the environment, by the pressure, or is it something that was already there in terms of your own wiring, but it got exacerbated or kind of opened up because of this experience. Either way, it shows that the experience itself, whether it's the origin of it or the exacerbation of it, should be the thing that's eliminated. That's the X in the equation that set everything off. And so, but here there's no room for even considering that, you know, which is really wrong.
Not at all. Not at all. I mean, that wasn't in the cards anywhere, never offered. No. But, you know, to speak to what you're saying, my mom did share with me, you know, when I was a teenager, when she got better, you know, so she did get better. It took her a while, but she did get better and overcame the agoraphobia without therapy. You know, surprisingly, she shared with me that she suffered from panic attacks, and that her very first panic attack was on the night before she married my dad.
Huh. Wow.
And so, you know, there you go, right?
Yeah.
But my guess is, you know, and having experienced panic attacks myself and knowing that there was a trigger, you know, for me, the trigger was when my children became the age that I was when the abuse started, when my sexual abuse started. I know that that can happen. And so, you know, like you said, what was the trigger? It's hard to know, you know, and I would certainly say Scientology could have definitely been one of the triggers, you know, and maybe just everything that was also going on in her conflicted life with, you know, being in the marriage that she was in and being so torn with where she wanted to be. You know, all of those things could have exacerbated it. But I definitely think that it did not help any of the Scientology training, auditing, anything that she did. That's not what helped. And finally, we moved to an apartment building in a little bit better part of downtown LA. And she got better. And I think part of it was she kind of had to rally because that was when my dad got sick. And, you know, he went downhill fast. And she had to get a job and she had to figure out a way for us to all survive. He was on disability benefits. My mom wasn't working at the time. And she was doing a little bit still with Scientology at the ASHO facility, which was close to us, which was the American Saint Hale organization. And so we moved to be a little bit closer to that, I think. And she was doing some work there. But she was actually, she was a great typist, and she was doing the typing up of the notes, which is kind of a weird thing, right? Yeah. So she was doing that. And maybe that was the way that they kept her in, because she couldn't go, you know, because of the agoraphobia, and she wasn't going. So I think they kept her that way. But anyway, she overcame it step by step. And years later, she shared with me when I was going through my own panic attacks, and she shared a book with me that she read that she said was helpful. But this is the crazy part about that. Like, I thought, oh, good, now my mom and I are going to connect. Like, I was so angry in the beginning that I inherited this. And then I thought, okay, now we're going to connect on it. And she shared this book with me, but she really couldn't talk about it. She really could not, like, engage. She could share the book, but I don't know if because it was still scary for her or she'd shut the door, but she just really could not be that nurturing mother that I needed to, like, okay, now we can talk about this. That didn't happen.
Oh, I'm sorry about that. That's really a shame. Really a shame. So from this time, you moved to a better part of downtown LA, which is good. And then what happened after that?
Well, that's when my dad got sick. So I was 13, and he went downhill fast. And so he was in a nursing home pretty quickly after the multiple sclerosis diagnosis. He was in a wheelchair within 6 months. He worked for a little tiny bit. He had worked out at Lockheed out in Palmdale area in California. And they really accommodated for him for a little bit. And then he couldn't do it any longer. He had gotten hand controls put on his car, and he probably should not even have been driving, to tell you the truth. It probably wasn't safe for him or for others, but he did for a while. And then he went into a nursing home. My mother got a job. And, you know, my brother and I were going to school at that time. And I saw a shift in my mom in that she, I don't want to say became empowered, but there was a sense of a little bit of freedom She had to get a car. She could drive to her job. She had to buy clothes for her job. I mean, there was this sense, a new sense of self. She also rebought all the furniture that had been, you know, repossessed in Louisiana and kind of, you know, decorated again in the home. And she really kind of emerged again. This is probably the best word for it. But she was slowly moving out of Scientology. And with my dad being gone, there really was now not the driver that you have to be involved, that you're the problem, that you have to get fixed. You know, and then that whole incident had happened. I think that she was handled a little bit with kid gloves by the Scientology organizations because they didn't want that to go south again, you know, and to be a problem. And so I think I was the scapegoat. I think I was the offering because that's when I became involved in Scientology. So at 13, I remember my mom, I was kind of voluntold that I was going to go and help at the newly opened Celebrity Center. And that's where, you know, Yvonne Gents was there. And, you know, it was fun. You know, I was 13. So I did. I got to walk because I didn't drive and my mother wasn't driving me. I mean, we really learned to be street kids. You know, we walked everywhere. So I walked to Celebrity Center from our apartment, which was about a 20-minute walk through downtown LA. And I was so happy to be out of my house. And, you know, my dad, it was right before actually when I started, before he went into the nursing home, you know, so things were not pleasant at home. You know, he was sick and it was not fun. And it was hard. It was hard as a kid to watch that. And I did have an allegiance to my father. You know, I had that strange dynamic with my, you know, abuser and with him. I aligned with him. He was my ally. So anyway, I got down to Celebrity Center and I had the fun job of, they were meshing the records of all the Scientologists because they took them from the Advanced Organization of LA and then they had to match them with the people at Celebrity Center and to see if there were duplicates. And everything was so old school. It was on a Rolodex, like the little Rolodex cards. So I remember like you'd pick up one. And then you'd have to look through all of the ones, you know, for Celebrity Center. Is it a match? Is it not a match? And if it wasn't, you had to put it in a special place. I mean, it was the most tedious, boring work. But I felt like, oh, this is kind of fun, like to be here with these adults and, you know, and I'm a kid. And so this is Scientology. Like, I didn't really know too much about it. And so I took a few courses and I started, you know, participating in the training. And I also, you know, I was there for about from 71 to about 75, 76 is when I left. I became an auditor. I was like probably one of the youngest auditors, but it was so, in some ways, it felt so empowering because I was treated like an adult. And, you know, when you're a teenager, that's all you want is to be an adult. You know, you want people, you know, to see you through those eyes, not as a kid. And so I felt that. I felt like I was just as worthy, you know, as the adults that were here in the room. The mantra in Scientology is, you know, we're all thetans, which is their kind of version of a soul, if you will. And we're all here, you know, to do this work. And you've lived a million lifetimes. You know, this just happens to be one of them. And you just happen to be in this young body. And this is where you are right now. And I remember somebody coming up to me and saying, you know, maybe when you get older, we can get married. You know, you're in this young body right now, but, you know, maybe that'll work for us later. And I remember thinking, yeah, maybe. Like, who knew?
Wow. That's incredible. So,
yeah, it was interesting. You know, and it was, again, a different time in Scientology. Then I've read so many ex-Scientologist stories, you know, and especially, you know, with Miscavige, you know, replacing L. Ron Hubbard and all of that. Not that L. Ron Hubbard, you know, was the greatest, but the organization at the time, again, it felt a little grassrootsy in LA in that it was the 70s and Celebrity Center opening, you know, and their whole mission was to bring in artists. And so it had that whole vibe, you know, they had poetry readings and, you know, events where artists would come. And so it had a different feel. You know, it had this new feel. and that it was really a positive. And it had a good feeling to it. But, you know, with all of the auditing and all of that, I did have experiences with auditing people that there were things going on that I couldn't comprehend as a teenager.
Mm-hmm. Okay. You know, like what sort of things?
I didn't have the life experience.
Right, right.
You know, I could follow the manual. You know, I could read the training routines. I could do everything I was told to do by my case supervisor and, you know, ask the questions and watch the e-meter, and I could do all of that, but I didn't really get it, you know, as an adult, because I was a kid. And so one time is kind of a funny one, is there was a woman and she was in an auditing session, and I must have like made a face or something because I was watching the needle and it was kind of going like all over, which was like not a good sign. That means something bad was happening. You know, there was some sort of lie or aberration or something happening that you needed to find out about from the pre-clear, the person you were auditing. And I said, oh, you know, no, I think we're okay. And she said, well, it's kind of hot in here. She had on a sweater. She said, I'm just going to take it off. And, you know, it's the 70s. So she had no bra on. Uh-huh. So then, you know, we were in a topless auditing session. And, you know, I remember as I'm sure my eyes like bugged out of my head, you know, thinking, oh my goodness, like what's going on? But, you know, I had to keep a straight face and and handle it. So that was kind of, you know, an amusing one. But I did have another incident where it was a gentleman that he was disclosing some incidents that had happened in the dorms there, because it was at the organization. They all lived in the dorms. And it was basically an incident of probably abuse. And he was the abuser, I believe. And so it was with another young Scientologist. And he talked about, you know, that there was this white liquid on the sheets. And he was explaining, you know, kind of a situation that had happened. And I remember him looking at me like to see what I was going to say. You know, how was I going to handle it? And I didn't really grasp the total significance. I knew it was not right, but I did grasp this. You know, I was barely sexually active, barely, you know, like I had one experience. And so I really didn't get it. And I certainly didn't get that something might have been happening between two men. You know, that was like out of my realm. That's not something I had experienced. And so I remember writing everything down and then, you know, being called in and being questioned about what he had said. And I really felt interrogated, like they were not happy. And I thought, you know, I did everything I was supposed to, like how I didn't understand why I was in trouble. And, you know, they interrogated me and then they said, okay, you know, and then they took him away. I did not audit him again. He was not my pre-clear anymore. And I remember then I didn't see him around, which doesn't mean he left, but I definitely didn't have any more interactions with him. And as an adult, you know, when I remembered that incident in the writing, it's been really hard, Rachel, because of being a sexual abuse survivor. And I have to forgive myself. I was a young child. I didn't know how to handle that situation, you know, and as an educator and as a mandated reporter now, you know, I mean, that's my career. I advocate for children all the time. And I think, I wish I could go back and fix that. I wish I could go back and, you know, and make that situation right for whatever was happening, you know, for that young Scientologist.
Sure. Yeah. Oh, that makes sense. I mean, that's certainly your conscience talking right now. And I was thinking about that. For myself, as an educator, as a therapist, being a mandated reporter twice over, there is a situation, and I know a lot of people have this sort of moral injury after having these experiences where they think they should have, or they wish they could have, fill in the blank, whatever it is, because their conscience is guiding them to really see that situation as having been wrong enough for this person to want to talk about it. He felt he needed to bring it up. So I think he had a sense that it was wrong too, whatever it is that happened. And especially because of your own childhood experiences, you're going to have sensitivity about that. I put the responsibility squarely on Scientology's shoulders in this situation. Even if, you know, your conscience is talking to you because you're a good person. But to put children in a situation like that, where they're hearing the stories of adults, which I've heard about quite a bit from people who have come to me and said, I was hearing about this and I couldn't report about that, or I was called on the carpet because, like, similar to you, I was given a hard time. But that you're exposed to things and exposed to things behind the scenes that are really beyond what someone your age, I think, should or could be exposed to, and also without any protection there for you emotionally, but also with no guideline about being a reporter, being a mandated reporter, needing to protect the people you're hearing about. You were not given that power, or it wasn't even introduced to you as an idea. And so I think, you know, you were put at a disadvantage, and whoever it is who was affected by whatever this man did was also put at a disadvantage, but not because of you. But I still understand the guilt.
Yeah, yeah. So, you know, that was, I don't know. The auditing, I liked doing it as a teenager. I mean, I felt, like I said, I felt empowered. I felt like I was an adult. I was participating in, you know, adult-like things. And that was probably the one negative, you know, experience that I had out of it. Most of it was not like that. But it still was weird, like you said, to hear, you know, adults talk about things, you know, from and being a child myself. And to be viewed as an adult. So I think there was, you know, that dichotomy also, in that I had this perception of myself that I could be this adult when I really couldn't.
Uh-huh.
You know, yeah. Right. I really couldn't, and I shouldn't. And so I think that was could have been a negative as well, you know, in choices that I made as a teenager, relationships that I, you know, had with boys, things like that. That said, you know, I got involved in some youth organizations outside of Scientology when I was a teenager, which were positive. And I had stopped kind of going to the org for a while. So I had started to pull back because I really could only do it like after school in the evenings and then in the summer. And, you know, my mom was working. My dad was now, you know, really out of the picture at the Veterans Administration. He had been moved because he was even sicker. And so I really didn't have that influence in my life saying, you need to go. And I think my mom, she was more involved in her own life at that time. So she had really pulled back as a parent too. During those teenage years, she became involved with another man and, you know, with my dad being gone, and she was living her life. So I got involved with this youth organization and stopped going. And then one day I was at my apartment and my mom was not there. And my boyfriend, who was actually my husband, but my boyfriend at the time, was there with me. And these guys knocked on the door, and they were from the Scientology org. So they knocked on the door and they said, you know, where you been? Hi, I opened the door, you know, hi, where you been? So they look in, and I didn't let them in, that I just stood at the door. And then, you know, they see my boyfriend, who's, he's very tall. He's like 6'5". So they see this very tall guy standing behind me. So I think they might've been a little intimidated, but they said, well, you know, where have you been? I said, oh, you know, I've been busy with school and things like that. And they said, oh yeah, you know, we want to see you back. That sell of, you know, when you need to come back, when you're coming back, trying to get a commitment out of you. But I felt like their superpowers were not as strong because they were kind of out of their element, you know, and my boyfriend was there and they just didn't know exactly what else to do. And so I said, oh, you know, yeah, yeah, you know, I think I said, I'll come back, you know, or I'll be back, you know, soon. Or, and they got me to commit to something. And that was that. But prior to that, I had been given the really hard sell to join the Sea organization. So they had their hooks in me, and they had told me that I could join at 16, that I didn't have to be 18, and that I didn't have to have my parents' permission. Whether that was true or not, I don't know. And they said, you know, you're going to sign the billionaire contract. And, you know, I had no sense of that either. I was you know, not happy with what was going on at home with my mom and my dad. And I thought, yeah, I'll do it. You know, I'm going to do it. I was being rebellious and, you know, that's what I'm going to do. And it looked appealing to me. You know, I saw these adults, seemed like they were having fun, seemed like, you know, I wanted to be one of them and be participating in everything that I knew they had secrets I wanted to learn about, you know, things they had done with the training and the auditing. So I came home and I told my mom, I'm going to join the Sea Org. And she was livid. She was livid. And we got into this big fight. I remember packing a bag. Like I was ready to go. I was emptying out my drawers. And she said, you cannot go. You cannot go. I mean, she was screaming at me. You cannot join. And I said, why? I can do it. You know, I can do it. I'm going to go. You know, I want to be part of the Sea Org. And she said, you cannot go. And she said, and if you do, I'm going to call the police. And I remember thinking, oh, like, I didn't know. Was that a bluff? Like, was she really going to call the police? And I was scared. I didn't know. So, you know, she called me on it. And I think she might have. I don't know. I don't know what she would have done. But she needed to threaten me with something. And so I took a step back. I cooled down. And I didn't. And everyone I've told that story to says, you dodged the biggest bullet ever.
Yeah, it's miserable.
The biggest bullet. I mean, yeah. If I had, you know, defied her and I had said, no, I'm going and walked out, my life would not be my life. I would have lived such a different life. And I'm so thankful that she did that day. I mean, and, you know, at the time I was so angry with her and so mad at her, you know, and thought that she was the enemy. But, you know, in hindsight, you know, I wish I could thank her for that and say, you know, that was a blessing that happened.
You know, I know we're getting close to the end of our time. I have two questions about that. When you say that your life would have been so different, it wouldn't have been your life. What if we were to imagine that you had gotten involved in the Sea Org, what would your life have been like or be like now? And also, why was your mom so adamant about this?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I think my mom, I'll start with that one, was so adamant about it because of her own experiences. So I think, again, she was so torn. Like, she saw me, you know, being involved in Scientology, but I think in her mind, it was, I don't want to say it was protected, but it was a gentler experience than maybe what she had. And so I think she was okay with that. Like, I went in the summers and at night and I participated and yeah, that seemed okay. And it was her way of kind of keeping that connection so they didn't come back after her probably. But I think once she saw that I had gotten in that deep and that's what I was thinking, that she probably saw my life flashing before her eyes. I mean, that's what I would think. And, you know, maybe I'm, you know, projecting that on her, but she was so angry and so upset about it. And that shocked me that she was so upset about it at the time. So, you know, had I joined, you know, I thought as a kid, I thought, oh, I'll make money, you know, I'll, you know, have clothes I can buy and I'll be having fun with all these Scientologists. Well, you know, the truth would have been working over 40 hours a week. I mean, they work, you know, night and day, working night and day, making less than minimum wage. You have no money. You have no freedom. If you were lucky enough to meet somebody in Scientology and make a connection, even if you got married, you never get to see that person. You live these crazy hours and the crazy life. Plus, no children are wanted, you know, in Scientology. They, you know, promote abortions and, you know, they really don't want anyone to have children. I mean, there was a period where you could, and then that was cut back, you know, in the 70s. But I would be not the person I am today because I wouldn't have gone to college. I wouldn't have learned everything I did. I wouldn't have had a family. I wouldn't have had, you know, I have four beautiful children. I wouldn't have had that. I have grandchildren. I mean, there's so much that I grieve for my mom that she didn't have, even though she had children and she had grandchildren before she passed, she didn't get to enjoy. She didn't get to enjoy motherhood. She didn't get to enjoy that life. So, you know, that's really what I would have lost.
Mm. So I know we're done with time. I'm just wondering now with your four kids, I'm sure as you're saying that, you know, you started having your own panic attacks when, yes, it is true, with when there's a chronology that matches up to your own experience as a child, it very often can cause panic. These experiences also sometimes really inform how you parent and the messages you want to make sure to send your kids, the lessons, the things to watch out for. And so, I mean, usually, you know, I will ask someone to sort of end their time talking to me with what they want the audience to really know about their experience, which you are welcome to share. But also, I'm curious about what you've made sure that your kids know.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it's been a journey to share my story with my family. I've really kept my story hidden at all costs to protect them. I really didn't want my children to know about my Scientology background. I wanted to close the door and never look back. Never, ever look back. So sadly, that didn't happen. I had a traumatic event in my life about 15 years ago that activated everything, that brought up these memories and a lot of things I had repressed. And that's when I started writing. And so I did start to share with my husband. I'd actually kept it secret for a couple of years because I really didn't even know what I was going to do with all of it. It was so frightening. And then when it started to come out, I did start to share it with my, you know, my children. And, you know, they've had their share of anxiety as well, you know, and we've been able to talk about that. Parenting is a very tricky business. And so, you know, I think I've done a good job, but you know, it's hard to know until they're all grown up and become parents themselves or, you know, older adults. So, you know, they're all doing okay. So I feel like I did something right. But I have, you know, recently with, you know, writing my book and everything, shared with them and shared my writing. And they've been so open and empathetic and just really embraced me. Which has just like, I not what I expected, you know, I wanted, but not what I expected. And I'm so thankful for that, so that we have that relationship. I think it's still hard for them, you know, to hear what I lived through and what my life was like. But I think they're, you know, they're proud of me and they feel like I'm doing the right thing by speaking out. That gives me a lot of comfort as well. And, you know, this is why I do it, because there's somebody out there that's going to listen to your podcast that's going to, even if it hasn't been Scientology, has been through a rough road of growing up and has had similar experiences and, you know, dealt with having to grow up way too fast and having all of those responsibilities and navigating illnesses with their family and abuse and, you know, not knowing, you know, how to handle it as a kid and pushing it down. And so I, you know, I speak to them that therapy is great. I've been through a lot of it. And journaling is what really helped me to just put thoughts down on paper and to get them outside of myself. And then just to be gentle with yourself. It's a journey. It's taken me years and years and years and years. You know, I'm in my sixth decade of life and I'm still learning about myself, you know, and I'm still learning how to heal. And it's a process. So I'm just so thankful that you do this work and that you give those of us an opportunity who have these stories, you know, to share them so that they can help people. And, you know, the work that you do is powerful and important.
Thank you. Thank you, Pam. And thank you to you for offering your stories and your insights. And you know, yes, it's going to bring up pain. It's not an easy experience. Diving deep inside to bring these stories out. But knowing exactly, as you said, that it's going to impact people for one reason or another, because your story resonates with so many people for so many reasons. But yes, you're a picture of adaptation. You just kind of know how to go with it. And even with panic here and there, you know what? Yeah, you can have that with all that you've been through here. You know, you come by it honestly. And so Thank you. Thank you for your time today, and thank you for your work. Where can people find you, your book, you know, if they want to find out more about your story?
Oh, thank you for asking that. Yeah. So my book is soon to be published, so it's not quite out yet, but they can go to Clearly Lies Are True. I have an Instagram account. I also have a TikTok account. I always say I'm the oldest person on TikTok. And then they can go to my website, which is also clearlyliesaretrue.com.
And after the book comes out, I'd love to have you, if it's okay with you, back on just to talk about what that experience has been like, to have your story be out there and the responses that you've gotten, because I'm sure there will be a lot of people who will really relate and be grateful to you for putting it out there. So thank you again for your time today.
Yes, thank you, Rachel.
One more thing before you go. I'm so glad you got to hear part one of my conversation with Pam today. It is really, really incredible to hear this story. It gives you kind of a window also into the beginnings of Scientology, kind of the ragtag nature of it, and being on a really decrepit kind of ship and having to make do in conditions that were, I'm sure, pretty difficult. And what's also interesting to keep in mind when you hear someone like Pam speak is that because of her childhood, because of just needing to deal with a huge amount of change in her life and upheaval and adaptation and just going with it and just learning how to be okay with things. When she says that something is hard, when she says that her mom had very severe symptoms, that things in her childhood, things in her life were really hard, she really means it. Because people with her background would typically normalize or downplay a lot of what happened that would be, I think, traumatizing to other people. So I really want you to hear her words with the gravity that they have. It is a frightening thing to suddenly have your world turned upside down, but also what you want, what you hope for when your world is shifted and where you live is shifted and you have a house, then you don't, then you're on a boat, then you don't know where you're living and who you're living with. And you want to know that there are things in your life that are stable. You want to know that the people in your life are stable and trustworthy. And when that isn't the case, you then need to know that you can trust yourself because you're on your own. And so Pam really got that message, I think, over and over again, that she was on her own and she was responsible for herself and for her sibling. It is unconscionable, I think, to hear about the things that happened to kids in this group and how they were really left to take care of things by themselves and make things okay in their own mind and just having to figure out how to survive and how to not let so much emotion register that you would just be incapacitated. I think you just learn to cut off that part of yourself so that you can just get through the day. One of the stories that she told, though, is about her mom really being scapegoated, so cruelly treated within this group, and the resulting psychosis, psychiatric disorder that her mom suffered with, and how she became agoraphobic and how she really became non-functioning. And it is so sad to hear these stories. And what makes it harder, not that you need anything here to make this harder, it's hard enough, is this phrase that I think I will never forget that Pam mentioned, that of course her mom having all of these symptoms, was not given proper psychiatric care. In fact, any kind of psychiatrist is demonized by Scientology. And the basis for that, that I've been told by people who were there at the start, at the beginning of L. Ron Hubbard's decline into psychosis himself, but also even early on in his career, when he was in the Navy, he was dishonorably discharged, even though he kind of fabricated and fashioned all of these awards and called himself the Commodore of his naval ships and really highlighted something about himself that was not the case, that he was diagnosed by naval psychiatrists as having different diagnoses and disorders that made him not safe to remain in the Navy. And so one of the things that people do when they don't want someone to be able to say something about them that people believe is that they put down the person saying it. So he couldn't go against the diagnoses, but he could decide to convince people in his organization that the people who diagnosed him, the psychiatrists, were people who were diagnosable, people who had something to gain by calling him that, people who were kind of lowly beings and who were disordered themselves. You can't affect the message, but you can defame the messenger. And so when here Pam, her mom really needed psychiatric help, well, that was not going to be something given to her, offered to her through Scientology, of course. And so she was left with needing to get treatment from them. And so that's sort of putting someone back into a situation that left them in this situation and having them have to get more of what made them so sick to begin with. And the phrase, as I mentioned before, that I will always remember is that she needed to get treatment from them until, quote, she was auditable again. So she was able then to be audited by them, that she was put back into the system, their system, of receiving more of their, quote unquote, counseling. Let's just get you better enough, according to how we see you being better, so that we can keep you in our system. Auditing also costs money, so we can keep getting something from you. We can keep making money off of you. It is, I think, really incredibly dangerous and selfish to put anyone through that. And to see that the only reason they should, quote unquote, get better is so that you can keep extracting more from them. I am so glad that Pam was able to move away from this system. And I can only imagine what some of her days in her childhood were like. She's a strong person, and I'm so glad that she's come on this show to talk about her experiences. To be continued. You'll hear more from her next week. Take good care. Talk to you then.
Thank you very much for listening. Please support Indoctrination on Patreon at patreon.com/indoctrination. Be sure to give us a follow on our social media. Find us on Facebook and Instagram using @indoctrinationpodcast. And for Twitter, find us @_indoctrination. We love hearing from you too. So send us an email at indoctrinationshow@gmail.com. And for more updates on the show, visit our website at www.podpage.com/indoctrination.
At KFC, everyday value meets big flavor. That means getting 6 crispy pieces of delicious dark meat drums and thighs, plus 4 biscuits, all for just $10 with our Dine and Dash deal.
all that juicy original recipe chicken for only $10 every day. Now that's finger-licking good. Hurry into KFC and taste the deal we're cooking up. Limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. While supplies last, tax, tip, and fees extra. Not available on third-party ordering platforms.